From 2000 to 2019, about 19,800 people died of an opioid-related overdose here in the Commonwealth. That data is from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And those are just the Massachusetts numbers. Yet accountability for the opioid crisis and the lives lost remains elusive. Many state attorneys general, including Massachusetts AG Maura Healey, have taken aim at Purdue Pharma, the company behind the powerful prescription opioid OxyContin. Healey expanded that effort just last week, filing a lawsuit against a marketing firm connected to Purdue Pharma for the role that it played in creating the opioid crisis. But there's also the Sackler family, founders and owners of multi-billion dollar Purdue Pharma, and we've covered them extensively on WBUR and Radio Boston, both the charges against them and their responses. You can find that coverage on our website, radioboston.org. The Sacklers are the focus of a new book from Dorchester native Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. We spoke with Keefe recently and began with the history of their signature drug, OxyContin, and its relationship to an even earlier drug, MS-Contin, essentially a morphine pill, that Purdue and the Sacklers gamed into the U.S. market without FDA approval.
The idea was that they wanted to develop a morphine pill so that you could administer morphine to people suffering from pain, but you wouldn't have to do it on an IV drip or with a needle. And they did. It had this very novel coating around the morphine. And the idea was that it would slowly regulate the flow of the drug into your bloodstream. This is the Contin in MS. Contin is short for continuous. And they sold it in the UK. And then they wanted to sell it in the U.S. And at that point, what you would normally do is go to the Food and Drug Administration and go through this pretty cumbersome bureaucratic process where you file a new drug application. But what Purdue Pharma elected to do was they said, well, you know, morphine's not a new drug. It's an old drug. It's been around for a long time. So we've just decided this isn't going to apply to us. We're just going to go ahead and start selling the drug without asking anyone's permission. And they went ahead and did it.
Is that phrase, we're just going to go ahead, is that a fair other subtitle for your book?
It might be. I mean, this was part of the reason that I was so intrigued by that episode, and indeed by other episodes that come earlier in the book. You know, I chose to tell a story that is a family saga, really covering about a century.
Yeah, generations.
Not just an OxyContin story. And part of the reason that I was interested in that is that there are all of these things that happen earlier that presage what happens later. And I think that moment with MS-Contin is fairly typical. They were going to see what they could get away with in terms of the regulatory environment. And they were going to come pretty close to the line in terms of, you know, potentially reckless behavior as a company.
All right. So OxyContin was different than MS-Contin, but the same tactics essentially went into marketing it and distributing it. It's almost like, and I am sorry for the pun, but I could not think of another way to describe this. It's almost like it was MS-Contin on steroids.
That's a good way of putting it. You know, it's funny. There are these amazing emails that I discovered where they're talking about how MS-Contin had been very successful for the company, but the patent was soon going to run out. And they were going to face generic competition on the product. And so they thought, we have to find something new that we can patent. And they were talking about other drugs that they could use with this Contin system. And they arrived on oxycodone. And oxycodone is another opioid. So both of these drugs, morphine and oxycodone, are derived from the opium poppy. And it's very strong. It's roughly twice as strong as morphine. But what they realized is that American doctors weren't as familiar with oxycodone. You would encounter it in drugs like Percodan and Percocet, which are kind of weaker painkillers where it's mixed with aspirin or acetaminophen. And they did these focus groups and they discovered that doctors thought that oxycodone was actually weaker than morphine. Now, the truth is it's stronger. It's much stronger. But they realized that doctors had this misapprehension. And there are these incredible emails in which very senior officials in the company say, let's not do anything to make them realize that they have that wrong. Let's let them continue to believe erroneously that this is a weaker drug and not a stronger one.
There was some other let's not do anything, too. One of the things that struck me was when you laid out in the book that Purdue didn't really research the addictive properties of OxyContin before marketing it. And how unusual is it for a company to not look into what a common sense would say is a serious potential side effect of the drug they are about to market? This is an opioid.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is one of the big key questions in this whole story, right? Is that humans have known for thousands of years that the opium poppy and various products derived from it, you know, has incredible therapeutic benefits in the sense that it can relieve pain, but also has this downside, which is that it can be very habit forming. It can cause physiological dependence and indeed addiction. And it's not just that Purdue didn't conduct tests on how addictive the drug might be prior to releasing it. It's that they devised a marketing push which actually said that it wasn't addictive, that they just kind of blithely assumed that it wasn't without having actually done any real scientific work to back that up. This was driven, I think, because they were looking to position the drug a little differently than they had with MS-Contin. So MS-Contin was really primarily for cancer pain. And there was a very deliberate conversation with OxyContin where they said, we want to go after a bigger market here. There's only so many people suffering from cancer pain. What about people who have back pain, sports injuries, injuries they got on the job, arthritis? That's the market we want. And so that was the push, as they said, doctors should be prescribing this. They shouldn't just use it for cancer. They should use it for all kinds of conditions. And don't worry, it's not addictive.
So I want to take a moment here to say that a key part of your story is the Sackler family. And they had a history of quote unquote innovation in marketing pharmaceuticals. Arthur Sackler wrote the book on how you modern day pharmaceutical marketing. And the family was deeply engaged at every step in this. I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of a passage that speaks to the culture of the Sacklers in Purdue. This is a section where Richard Sackler is giving a speech to Purdue sales reps right after the launch of OxyContin. He almost missed the speech because of a major blizzard here on the East Coast, which he saw as a, quote, omen of change, end quote. Maybe you can pick it up from there.
A generation earlier, when Arthur Sackler helped Pfizer turn Librium into a blockbuster, the company had made it happen by recruiting an army of aggressive salespeople. Now, Purdue would do the same for OxyContin. And, Richard proclaimed, the snowstorm back in Connecticut would be remembered as a mystical portent of their success. The launch of OxyContin tablets will be followed by a blizzard of prescriptions that will bury the competition, he predicted. The prescription blizzard will be so deep, dense, and white that you will never see their white flag.
And this blizzard was an apt metaphor, it turns out. And in fact, you lay out that Purdue actually tracked and targeted doctors who were prescribing a lot of OxyContin, pushed them to prescribe more, set that as a strategy managed by the family. Talk a little more about that.
Yeah, I mean, there was this big push. I think there was just huge ambition for this drug. And there was a, you know, I should say, I think there was greed, but I also think there was idealism. There was a sense that throughout human history, it had been impossible to disentangle the risky aspects of opioids, you know, from the therapeutic benefits. And they felt like we've cracked it. We've hacked it. We figured out a way to get opioids to people who are suffering from pain in such a way that they won't have to worry about addiction. Now, all of this turns out to have been conjecture and wrong. But what they did was they had this army of salespeople who went out and they met with thousands and thousands of doctors across the country. I've interviewed these former sales reps. They were very heavily incentivized to get doctors prescribing as much as they could. They all said they had this line that they repeated like a mantra where they would say, it's not addictive. It's addictive less than 1% of the time. Less than 1% of the time. That's what they said again and again. The tagline, the kind of marketing phrase for OxyContin was, it's the one to start with and the one to stay with. So the idea was this is not some nuclear solution that you graduate to when other courses of therapy have failed. This is what you, the first thing you do if somebody comes to you in pain is you prescribe them OxyContin.
So clarifying, the 1% was not an accurate claim.
It wasn't. It was a totally bogus claim. I think the company and the family was soon confronted with evidence of that because it really didn't take long for the problems with the drug to make themselves known. But to me, that's where it becomes a really interesting story, is how they get kind of stuck in when it turns out that their initial hypothesis about the drug and what it can do turns out to be wrong. It's the sort of collective denial and delusion that they have in insisting that there's not a problem when there clearly is one.
So the Sackler family is where this story comes home to Massachusetts in a number of ways. Tufts became the first major university to remove the Sackler name from buildings and programs in 2019. That seems to have set off a chain reaction, a sort of next level abnegation of the Sacklers. Why do you think Tufts was the first to actually do it? And talk about the impact that had on a family who wanted its name public in philanthropy and hidden in business.
A couple of things happened. You know, there's this paradox that kind of runs through this story. And it's not just recent. I mean, this happened, I was able to trace it right back to the 1950s, where the family was very determined to put their name, the Sackler name, on all of their charitable gifts and gifts to museums, gifts to universities. You have Sackler Halls and Sackler Wings and Sackler Lecture Series, but never on the family business. And this was true in the 1960s when Arthur Sackler makes the first great fortune by marketing Valium, another addictive drug, but also true in the 1990s. And even when I started writing about Purdue Pharma initially in 2017, you could go to the website of Purdue Pharma, this company that the family owns that has generated all these billions, and search for the Sackler name, and you wouldn't find it anywhere. There was no acknowledgement on the company's website that it was owned by the Sackler family. So it's this weird thing where they put their names on all the philanthropy, but then keep their name off of the family business. And the real turning point, you know, I wrote a piece about the Sacklers in 2017 in The New Yorker. And at the time, I didn't think it would be possible to write a book because they were so secretive. And the big turning point for me happened in early 2019 when Maura Healey did something that nobody else had done up to that point, where pretty much every state in the union was suing Purdue Pharma over its role in the opioid crisis. But the state of Massachusetts sued individual members of the Sackler family for their role in helping direct what was happening at the company and named a bunch of the family members who had sat on the board of the company. And that, I think, was a big turning point because it laid out in black and white in this big legal complaint all the evidence that this was not some remote family that was checked out and just collecting the checks. They were calling the shots. In terms of Tufts, it was the students. It was the students. It was medical students at Tufts who said, I don't want to go and learn to be a doctor in a building that is named after this family. And the Tufts administration was, you know, they really listened to the students and eventually decided to take this quite radical step, which was to literally chisel the name off the walls.
So Attorney General Maura Healey here in Massachusetts names 8 Sacklers. You lay out that by the time she takes that step, they have extracted significant, if not most, money out of the company into personal accounts, sheltered accounts, etc. And you argue in anticipation of something like what A.G. Healey did.
Yeah, I mean, it's this crazy aspect of the story. And I should say it wasn't just significant, it was most. So in 2007, Purdue Pharma pled guilty to federal criminal charges of misbranding OxyContin. And they ended up actually pleading guilty again to a new set of federal criminal charges just this last year in 2020. And in the interim, you have all these states like Massachusetts bringing their own lawsuits against the company. What the public didn't know until fairly recently is that in the run-up to this period, the Sacklers are quietly pulling money out of the company. $300 million here, $400 million there. They end up taking more than $10 billion out of the company. And then when you have this huge kind of tsunami of lawsuits, they say, oh, too bad. Company doesn't have any money left. Purdue's going to declare bankruptcy and basically said, we can't fight these lawsuits. We can't settle these lawsuits. We just don't have enough money. There's not enough money left. And the Sacklers are sitting on the sidelines, having pulled more than $10 billion out of the company. And they seem, at least for the moment, to be protected.
Ultimately, Attorney General Healey and other attorneys general like New York's Letitia James rejected a $10 billion settlement that was offered by Purdue and favored by some Republican attorneys general. It didn't reflect Sackler money, really. It didn't inflict financial harm on the Sacklers. The argument was that it wasn't enough, didn't really represent accountability. Later, the company reached a lighter settlement with the Department of Justice. Maury Healey has called that chump change. It doesn't name names or bring criminal charges against anybody. You paint that decision as a reader, it felt to me, in an attractive light, the decision not to compromise or take that settlement. In retrospect, is there an argument to be made that Maura Healey should have engaged more with the initial settlement offer to get some money that appeared to be on the table for things like addiction programs, local governments fighting the crisis on the ground, et cetera?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. I mean, I should say, and it all gets extremely complicated, but to break it down a little bit, initially the proposal by Purdue and the Sacklers, they alleged that this was a $10 to $12 billion proposal that they were making. I think when you actually look at the math, you know, and when you start breaking down those big multi-billion dollar numbers, a lot of that was pretty conjectural and sort of based on future profits from sales of things. I mean, it was, you know, in terms of the actual cash on the barrel, it was a much smaller number that they were offering. Specifically, the Sacklers were offering $3 billion of their own money. And Maura Healey at the time, and some of the other, as you say, the more kind of forward-leaning state attorneys general said, that's not enough. You know, they would be walking away with the huge bulk of a fortune which they pulled out of this company during a period of time at which we now know it was committing federal crimes. As to whether or not that was a savvy decision by Maura Healey to reject the initial offer, the Sacklers have subsequently upped their offer to $4.25 billion. Of their own money. So it, just in terms of the kind of pure negotiation, I think it was probably pretty smart not to take the initial offer.
You know, I sort of reached the final pages, about 450 pages into the book, and there's this journey we've been on. I know the public reporting, right, obviously, but I think I thought there was going to be a level of comeuppance that it feels like, it sounds like, it reads like just didn't happen. Is that right?
I think it is right. Look, on some level, this is a book about impunity. It's about the way the super elite in this country, the billionaire class, tend to be insulated at every level of the system from any real accountability for their actions, no matter how hazardous and disastrous those actions might be. I think the way this is going to end is that the Sacklers will end up giving up several billion dollars of their own money. They will walk away with vastly more. I don't know that there's going to be, you know, I don't think they'll face criminal charges. I don't know that there's going to be comeuppance of the sort that if you were a, you know, a retail heroin dealer selling heroin on the street, you might be faced with. I think they'll be insulated from that. You know, there's an anecdote that I relate in the book about Isaac Sackler, the original patriarch, the father of the original three Sackler brothers. And during the Great Depression, he loses everything and he gathers his sons. He tells them, listen, I have nothing to give you. I have no money. You're going to have to pay for your own educations. But I've given you the most important thing that a parent can give their children, which is a good name. This is at the height of the Depression. He says, you know, if you lose a fortune, you can always earn another one. But if you lose your good name, you can never get it back. And to me, that is this very powerful moment because it explains both the frenzy with which the Sacklers have put their names on things. But I think it also does articulate a kind of comeuppance. It's not justice. It's not real accountability. But I do think that this is a family that has been engaged in the kind of brand management of the family name for seven decades. And I do think that at this point, the public has woken up to what happened with OxyContin and to the family's role in this. And so I think they've lost the good name. And that is something that I think they will never get back.
Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the new book, Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.